So let me start off by asking you a question. Do you watch Korean dramas? By that response, I'm guessing a lot of you do. Don't be embarrassed if you do. I'm sure many of you do, if not all of you, have watched Korean dramas or currently are addicted to Korean dramas. It's basically Korea's lasting contribution to the world, you know? There's nothing much that we give. Maybe it's Samsung, but they don't make very good phones anyway. I like apples. So I used to watch a lot of them, And that's actually, that's where I learned a lot of my Korean, not from my parents, not from Korean school that I went to every Saturday, begrudgingly. But I learned a lot of my Korean from watching Korean dramas. And I had to stop because it just took up way too much time. And I got addicted to them. And so if you watch them, you know what I'm talking about. If you've watched Korean dramas before or are currently watching them now, you know what I'm talking about, because after you watch one episode, you're like, what? It can't end right there. I got to find out what happened. And so you end up watching the next one, right? And then before you know it, it's like 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. The sun is starting to rise, and you realize you watched more than you should have. And so for the sake of my soul, I needed to stop watching it. And that was right around the time I met my wife, Grace. And then so instead of watching Korean dramas, I just started making my own. And you can ask my wife, Grace. I'm drama. So I also stopped watching Korean dramas because I realized, after watching several of them, that if you watch one series of Korean dramas, you've pretty much watched all of them, right? Because they're all based on a formula, and the formula is the same. Okay, let me share with you some of those formulas. For instance, there's always a love triangle. Two guys, one girl, two girls, one guy. Always. There's always this, some sort of love triangle. Also, there's a rich family, and then there's a poor family. Either the guys from the rich family, or the girls from the rich family, or the guys from the poor family. And the rich family is just having none of it. They don't like the fact that they're dating some sort of poor pauper. Also, there's always a freeze frame at the end of every episode where there's a guy walking away from a girl, or a girl walking away from a guy, or if you're lucky, they're walking past each other, and they have no idea that they just did that, right? And you know that's true. Okay. Also, in every Korean drama, there is someone that is dying, or someone has just come out of a coma. And every doctor in Korea is a surgeon. There are no general practitioners. No GI, there is no, like, no, the Koreans only produce surgeons. That's all they only know how to rip people open, okay? Then, the ultimate scene, there's always rain, there's crying, and if you're lucky, there's a 360 camera pan of the guy with his hands open to the air saying, why? Why won't you just love me, right? So if you've never watched a Korean drama before, I'm sorry to break it to you. I pretty much told you the storyline of every Korean drama that exists. You just don't need to watch any of them. In fact, the series of pictures I just showed you, you've seen all of them now, okay? So while Paul's missionary life, how you transition from that, well, Paul's missionary life is no Korean drama. There has certainly been a lot of drama in his missionary journeys as a result of those who have opposed him. And also, much like a Korean drama, Paul's persecution and his imprisonment has become pretty predictable and almost formulaic. And there's a lot that we can learn from that. And so there has been, after ministry success, there's been false accusation, false imprisonment, someone is after him and giving him death threats, or beating him up almost to death, right? And there's always a gang of Jews out to get rid of him. And it happens over and over and over again as he goes from city to city. And it's no different as Paul has been coming into Jerusalem. And so if you've been following us along, if you've been with our church for a while and you've been following in our series in Acts, you know that we've been going through all of Paul's missionary journeys, and he's at the tail of his journey where he finally returns to Jerusalem. That's where we pick up. And in today's passage, it's as his missionary journeys come to a close, the drama ramps up like tenfold, and so does the persecution. And in today's passage, even though as the persecution and drama ramps up, there's a voice. There's a calming voice that gives courage in chaos. And so we're going to see how courage can be brought out in chaos. And so if you would open up your Bibles with me, the book of Acts. Toward the end, Acts chapter 22, and we're going to start in the last verse, chapter 22, verse 30. And we're going to be reading the whole chapter of 23 after that. If you don't have a Bible with you, there should be Bibles in the pockets in front of you. If you don't own a Bible, please take that home with you. Acts chapter 22, verse 30. Now, just to help you, if you could think of a, like, dramatic, tense soundtrack in the back of your head, this is what's going to happen. Like, if you watch Homeland, listen to that background. If you remember 24, listen to that. Remember that that music in the background, okay? But on the next day, desiring to know the real reason why he was being accused by the Jews, he unbound him and commanded the chief priests and all the council to meet. And he brought Paul down and set him before them. And looking intently at the council, Paul said, "Brothers, I have lived my life before God in all good conscience up to this day." And the high priest Ananias commanded those who stood by him to strike him on the mouth. Then Paul said to him, "God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Are you sitting to judge me according to the law, and yet contrary to the law you order me to be struck?" Those who stood by said, "Would you revile God's high priest?" And Paul said, "I did not know, brothers, that he was the high priest. For it is written, 'You shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people.'" Now when Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, "Brothers, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees. It is with respect to the hope and the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial." When he had said this, a dissension arose between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. For the Sadducees say there is no resurrection, nor angel, nor spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. Then a great clamor arose, and some of the scribes of the Pharisees' party stood up and contended sharply, "We find nothing wrong in this man. What if a spirit or an angel spoke to him?" And when the dissension became violent, the tribune, afraid that Paul would be torn to pieces by them, commanded the soldiers to go down and take him away from among them by force and bring him into the barracks. The following night, the Lord stood by him and said, "Take courage, for you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem. So you must testify also in Rome." When it was day, the Jews made a plot and bound themselves by an oath neither to eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. There were more than 40 who made this conspiracy. They went to the chief priests and elders and said, "We have strictly bound ourselves by an oath to taste no food till we have killed Paul. Now therefore, you along with the council, give notice to the tribune to bring him down to you, as though you were going to determine his case more exactly. And you're ready to kill him before he comes near." Now the son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush. So he went and entered the barracks and told Paul. And Paul called one of the centurions and said, "Take this young man to the tribune, for he has something to tell him." So he took him and brought him to the tribune and said, "Paul the prisoner called me and asked me to bring you this young man to you, and he has something to say to you." The tribune took him by the hand and going aside asked him privately, "What is it that you want to tell me?" And he said, "The Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down to the council tomorrow, as though they were going to inquire something more closely about him. But do not be persuaded by them, for more than 40 of their men are lying in ambush for him, who have bound themselves by an oath neither to eat nor drink till they have killed him. And now they are ready, waiting for your consent. So the tribune dismissed the young man, charging him, "Tell no one that you have informed me of these things." Then he called two of the centurions and said, "Get ready 200 soldiers with 70 horsemen and 200 spearsmen to go as far as Caesarea at the third hour of the night. Also provide mounts for Paul to ride and bring him safely to Felix the governor." And he wrote a letter to this effect: "Claudius Lysias, to His Excellency the Governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them when I came upon them with the soldiers and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman citizen. And desiring to know the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their council. I found that he was being accused about questions of their law, but charged with nothing deserving of death or imprisonment. And when it was disclosed to me that there would be a plot against this man, I sent him to you at once, ordering his accusers also to state before you what they have against him." So the soldiers, according to their instructions, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. And on the next day, they returned to the barracks, letting the horsemen go on with him. When they had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they presented Paul also before him. On reading the letter, he asked what province he was from. When he learned that he was from Sicilia, he said, "I will give you a hearing when your accusers arrive." And he commanded him to be guarded in Herod's Praetorium. So when we left Paul last week, he was about to be flogged. He wanted to talk to the Jews out in front of the temple, and he was trying to talk to them, and they got all mad, and, you know, Lysias had no idea what's going on, and so in order to figure out what's going on, he was about to flog him. And that's when he found out that Paul was a Roman citizen. And so in order to understand what's going on here, we have to understand the political climate of Jerusalem, all of Israel. And so Israel had been conquered by the Roman Empire at this time, and nobody liked the Roman Empire. So much so that there are rebel groups within Israel that were trying to overthrow the Roman Empire. And if that didn't accomplish anything, they were just doing guerrilla warfare and killing as many Roman soldiers as they could. And so all that to say, it was pretty tense in Jerusalem. And I don't think it'd be a stretch to say that it's a lot like the political climate it is in the Middle East that is today. So there's a delicate dance that Lysias, the guy in charge of Jerusalem, that he has to play. On the one hand, he has to keep the peace between Israel and the Roman Empire. But on the other hand, he has to do whatever it takes to protect a Roman citizen, Paul, because by law, he is required to have due process. So trying to figure out what's going on, he calls the Sanhedrin, and the Sanhedrin is the group of political leaders for the Jews. And they're made up of the Sadducees and the Pharisees. And they call them in and try to figure out what's going on. And Paul, in this season of life, he just can't win. He can't do anything for the life of him just to get an edge. No matter how faithful he is and no matter how honest he is, he just can't win. Even though he is articulate and he is persuasive, even though he is smart and passionate, he just can't win. He just can't get ahead. And no matter how hard he tries, he's not going to get out of this situation because all the cards are stacked against him. So Paul tries to tell the Sanhedrin that when they come, that all of his life he has tried to live with honor and integrity in the way that he has approached God. And what he gets for this comment is a sock in the mouth. And the reason for this sock in the mouth is because of Ananias. And he could have said anything he wanted to say, good or bad, he wouldn't have won. And the reason for that is because Ananias, the high priest, first of all, he doesn't like Paul. It's pretty clear. Second of all, Ananias, the high priest at this time, he's pretty corrupt. He was not only pro-Roman, but he took bribes from people in order to get their way or his way. And then he was also pretty violent. He would kill off people to get his way. And then also, he would allow his servants to steal the offering that was meant for the priests, as people gave offering to the temple. And so, needless to say, he was pretty corrupt. And there was no way that Ananias was going to allow Paul to win out on anything. And so, in a moment of anger, Paul calls Ananias a whitewashed wall. Pretty much, he's just bad-mouthing him and calling him a hypocrite. And then, after that, Paul tries another tactic. Seeing that the Sanhedrin, this political leadership, is made up of Pharisees and Sadducees, he tries to gain the empathy of the Pharisees by saying, guys, look, I am a Pharisee. I am a son of a Pharisee. I am a Pharisee of Pharisees. I believe in the same thing you do. I believe in the hope that one day that we will be resurrected. And thinking that he would gain some empathy from this group, what happens is that it's not empathy that he gains, is that it creates even more dissension and argument and creates violence between the two groups, so much so that Lysias, the guy in charge, thinks that he's going to get torn apart. And so they take him to the barracks, basically the fort, the Roman fort. And they do that so that he doesn't get torn up, but then also the Romans don't get torn up either. So Paul just can't catch a break. He can't win. No matter how hard he tries, no matter what skills he employs, there's nothing that he can do to catch a break. No matter how faithful he is, no matter how much integrity he has, he just can't win. You know, there aren't many things that I enjoy about Facebook. In fact, I try to stay away from Facebook as much as possible. But the one thing I do enjoy is that I get to connect with friends that I rarely get to see anymore, seeing their kids grow up and what they're up to and things like that. But if there's one thing that I've learned in my scouring of, I guess I'm a stalker, if my scouring of Facebook is that life is pretty fragile. Because on the one hand, you see people getting married, getting engaged, announcing the birth of their baby, talking about new exciting chapters of their lives. But on the other hand, just below it, below a post, you'll see people asking for prayer because their child is in the hospital. One of my friends, his daughter has stage 4 cancer. Another friend of a friend said that he got bullied at school and got knocked over and had a huge severe trauma to his brain. There are people who are struggling with health. They're struggling with their marriages, death in the family. And it's all juxtaposed next to each other. They're placed next to each other. And if you just take a step back and look at all the posts, you realize, man, life really is fragile. How is it that on the one hand, we can celebrate life, but on the other hand, life brings us so much sorrow? Life is really fragile. And it comes very clear when you see that. So let me ask you a question. Are you in a season of life or in a situation right now where no matter how hard you try, no matter how faithful you try to be, no matter how much integrity you try to uphold, you just can't catch a break? You feel like, I just can't win, no matter how hard I try. Even if we know, and we preach every week, that as Christians, that it doesn't exempt us from pain and difficulty, that God gives us these pains and seasons of life, even if we know that in our mind and we teach it every week, it's still hard to go through those seasons of life. It sucks. No one wants to go through it. And so what do you ask yourself? What do you do? How do you get out of this season? How do you walk through it? And I'm sure Paul was asking himself the same question. And God came to him and gave him that answer that same night. As Paul was sitting there in the jail cell, he was in a literal and figurative dark place. And Jesus gives him his answer in verse 11. He says, the following night, the Lord stood by him and he said, take courage. For as you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must testify also in Rome. And so just as it is formulaic, as it was or it is formulaic, for Paul to endure persecution after ministry success, as we see this pattern coming over and over again, there's also a formula, there's also a pattern in which Jesus comes to Paul and gives him words of assurance, or gives him words of encouragement, or gives him his presence when Paul needed the most. When there was a ministry crossroads, or when he was suffering in a time of crisis, Jesus comes to him. 5 times, in fact, in the book of Acts. Every time when Paul endures a crossroads in ministry, Jesus comes to him. He met him at the road of Tarsus. He met him when he was in jail, beaten. And he's meeting him here today. And in the same way, just as God met Paul, and just as God came to Paul when he needed that reassurance, God will come to us, and he'll give us the words of reassurance and confidence and courage to keep going on. And he'll do it through simple ways, and he'll do it through miraculous ways to give us that courage. When there's chaos surrounding us, he will give us courage. How does he give us courage? He gives us courage through a podcast. He gives us courage through a sermon. He gives us courage through scripture. He might give us courage through a friend, or he might give us courage through an unexpected email. He might give you courage through a simple passage that you're reading in a book that has absolutely nothing to do with faith. He might give you courage through a conversation. And he uses these ordinary means to do extraordinary things in our hearts so that we would remain faithful and that we would keep moving forward toward the cross. And in this instance, God chooses to use Paul's nephew. And we've never heard of Paul's nephew before. We never knew that Paul had a nephew. We didn't even know Paul had a sister before. But somehow, Paul's nephew decides to show up in this exact time. And during this time, for the person that we've never heard before, he miraculously overhears what's going to happen to Paul. And he shares this particular story and plan to Paul that someone is out to kill him. These 40 guys are out to kill him. And so Paul tells his nephew that you need to tell Lysias, the guy in charge. So he goes and tells Lysias, the guy in charge. And basically what Lysias does is he gathers all of the army, not really, but he gathers what seems like a battalion of soldiers to get Paul from one place to another, right? He gets soldiers, he gets spearmen, he gets horses, and it seems like it's overkill. But again, if you understand back to the political climate of what's going on here during this time, he has to keep the peace on the one hand, but on the other hand, he needs to protect Paul's life. And if he loses Paul's life, that's a bad mark on him, and he might be removed or even might be punished. And so it's not out of the realm of ridiculousness that he would be doing this. And so they make a hard day's travel to Caesarea, to Felix, the governor who is in charge of the whole area. You know, I've also often wondered when I read this passage or these passages like this, that when Paul is being shuffled from one place to another, like, what is he thinking during these times, on horseback or on a ship? What is he thinking when he's like not on the move, but he's being moved? What is his prayer in his heart when he's in a moment of chaos and darkness? Luckily for us, we're able to see a glimpse of that as we look into his letters, and we get a glimpse of his heart. In Philippians, he tells us, you know, I know what it means to have a lot. I know what it means to have a little. I know what it means to be high, and I know what it means to be low. And at the end of the day, I can do all things through Christ who gives me strength. He finds contentment in Christ because he knows that Jesus is faithful, and he is faithful to his promises. And that even though he might be going through a situation or a season of chaos, that he can rely on Jesus who is faithful to him. Maybe you're going through a season of chaos right now. Maybe you are in a situation right now where it feels so chaotic. Perhaps as a student, you feel the pressure of school. And you feel like you need to keep up with everyone. But you feel like you just can't keep your nose above water. And it's creating chaos in your heart. And it just seems like life is chaotic in itself. And no matter how hard you try, no matter how hard you study, no matter how much integrity you have to not cheat, it just feels like you can't get it your own way. And no matter how hard you try to please your parents by giving that last effort, it just seems like there's no way to please them. Jesus would tell you, take courage. Perhaps your marriage is in chaos. You try to speak to your spouse, but they don't want to have anything of it. You feel like you might sleep in the same room, but your world's apart. And no matter how hard you try, no matter how hard you pray, you feel like your marriage is in chaos. Or maybe you feel like you're trying to get through to your kid, but they're ignoring you. There's no words that you could say how soft or how hard. It just seems like you can't get through to them. And you feel like the relationship that you have between them is just chaotic. And Jesus would tell you, take courage. Perhaps your work life is chaotic. You're unhappy. You can't get along with your coworkers. You're past your deadlines. The pressure of work is just creating chaos. And no matter how hard you try to meet them in the middle, no matter how hard you try to meet that deadline, or no matter how hard you try to alleviate some of that pressure, you feel like you're going back to the same chaos. And Jesus would tell you, take courage. And maybe your health is in chaos. You've been shuffled back and forth from one doctor to another, and they can't tell you exactly what it is, but they just say, take this particular medicine and you might feel better, but it's not working. And you feel like you're praying to the Lord for healing, and you feel like he's not listening and he's not standing there with you. But take heart, because he is standing there next to you. And he's saying, take courage. And perhaps your personal life, the realm of your heart, you feel like there's just so much chaos surrounding you. Whether it's because of an addiction, whether it's because there's a dark place in your life, you just feel like you can't get anything straight. And no matter how hard you pray, and no matter how hard you read the Bible, and you talk to people, no matter how many podcasts you listen to, or how many sermons you hear online, you just feel like everything just seems so chaotic, and there's just no end in sight. And Jesus would say, I'm standing there next to you. Take courage. Remain faithful. And so as much as the Lord stood by Paul that night and his season of chaos, where he felt like he just couldn't get anything right and all the cards were stacked against him, he just couldn't catch a break, even though he knew what was going to happen to him, even though he was walking through a dark place, Christ stood right next to him in that jail cell, and he told him to take heart. Take courage. There's more in store for you. And for you that are going through a season of chaos, for you that feel like you're in a dark place, you may not realize it, but Jesus is standing right next to you. He's standing right next to you, and he's saying, take courage. I'm here with you. Let's pray.